From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Israel holds parliamentary elections. International aid troubles facing Syrian refugees. Russian weapons challenge Ukrainian military. A 150-year-old American symbol gets cleaned up. These stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. Israel's almost 6 million voters are going to the polls today to elect a new parliament and decide whether the conservative Likud party leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, will serve a fourth term as prime minister. On Monday, Mr. Netanyahu reversed an earlier stance on Palestinian statehood, saying he'll never support a Palestinian state if he is returned to office. No party is expected to win more than one quarter of the seats. That means the outcome will likely decide on whether right-wing groups or left-wing parties can win enough votes to form the next coalition government. VOA's Scott Bob reports.
Thousands of people rallied in Tel Aviv to support a final push by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ahead of Tuesday's parliamentary elections. Opinion polls released Friday, the last day for polling allowed before the election, show the Prime Minister's Likud party trailing by several seats behind a center-left alliance led by the opposition Labour Party. Mr. Netanyahu urged supporters to turn out in force.
Godel ha-par ben ha-miflagot ha-mitcharot ala ha-anaga yachol liyot gorem machria.
He says the size of the gap among the parties vying to lead the countries can be a decisive factor in who will form the next government. This is a fateful struggle. It's a close struggle, he says. We must close this gap. A center-left alliance led by Labour leader Yitzhak Herzog surged in the final days of the campaign. Herzog told supporters at an earlier rally that after 6 years of Netanyahu-led governments, it was time for a change. He says we must come together, we must unite and work together to succeed, and we will win because it's either us or him. Neither Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party nor Herzog's Zionist Union alliance is expected to come close to winning the 61-seat majority needed to form the next government. As a result, both sides are jockeying to attract the support of smaller parties, ranging across the political spectrum from communist to Orthodox Jewish. Hebrew University professor Abraham Diskin notes that 12% of voters are undecided, and they could determine the outcome.
All the right-wing parties combined do not have a majority. All the left-wing parties combined do not have a majority, and in the center we have two parties.
He says two relatively new centrist parties have been gaining ground and could determine which side forms the next government. But four Arab-led parties have joined forces for the first time in history. The polls indicate that their unity list could win enough seats to make it the third largest party in parliament. Its leaders say they could back a left-wing government, or in the case of a national unity government of both the right and the left, they could lead the opposition. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held a new round of talks Monday with his Iranian counterpart in Switzerland as an end-of-the-month deadline looms to reach agreement on curbing Iran's nuclear program. Lisa Bryant has details.
Reports suggest that after months of talks, Western powers in Iran are getting closer to reaching a framework agreement on Tehran's nuclear program. Just how close, however, is unclear. Negotiators have set a March 31st deadline. That's a date Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif are working against after beginning several days of discussions in Lausanne, Switzerland. Speaking to CBS News before traveling to Switzerland, Kerry says it's important not to get just any deal, but the right deal.
If it's peaceful, let's get it done. And my hope is that in the next days that will be possible.
In Brussels on Monday, British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said key differences remain. European Union foreign ministers were meeting with Zarif later in the day.
We're closer than we were, but we've still got a long way to go. So there are areas where we've made progress, areas where we have yet to make any progress. But I think the fact that we're all here talking shows the commitment on all sides to try to reach an agreement.
For his part, German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier urged all sides to seize the opportunity to reach a deal after a years-long standoff. Tehran argues its nuclear program is for completely peaceful purposes, but many countries believe it's trying to develop a nuclear weapon. The overall goal is for an agreement to constrain Iran's nuclear program for a decade and gradually ease international sanctions against Tehran. The Associated Press news agency reports that instead of striking a deal by the end of the month, the two sides might only announce that enough progress has been made to keep on talking. There are a number of unresolved issues, including on Iran's centrifuges, international inspections, and just how long sanctions would remain in place. There are also skeptics on both sides, including among many Republican members of Congress in the United States. Earlier this month, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said Iran's commitments to date don't go far enough. And in Iran, a number of clerics and military leaders oppose an agreement as well. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Negotiators have set a June 30th deadline to finalize an accord. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad says he is awaiting action from Washington to match the words of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who expressed interest in negotiating with the Syrian leader's government. Secretary Kerry says the United States would ultimately have to reach a deal with the leader for a political transition of power. More than 200,000 people have been killed in Syria's four-year civil war. Half the population in Syria is displaced because of the Syrian civil war. 4 million people have left the country. Resources in neighboring countries are being stretched to the limit. In the Jordanian capital, Amman, workers say prices and tensions are rising quickly as international aid becomes harder to get. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more.
There are no bombs going off these days in Jordan, but families say since the Syria war began, everything has changed. Salah Awad is a taxi driver and the father of 9 children. As he eats lunch with his family off a large cloth on the floor, he says rent has gone up by 75% in recent years. And as refugees pour out of Iraq as well as Syria, he says, competition from laborers who will work for almost nothing makes it almost impossible to make enough money to pay the bills. 10% of the people in Jordan are now refugees from Syria, but international aid is dwindling along with the patience of host countries, says Andrew Walker, who heads the United Nations Refugee Agency in Jordan.
Over time, the welcome mat gets thinner and thinner. I think the security situation in the region magnifies the concerns of Jordanians of what the impact the refugees have.
The impact, he says, includes sharing the limited resources of Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, the countries where most Syrian refugees now live. The United Nations is seeking $3 billion for Jordan alone, but so far has raised only 5% of the money.
And on top of that, you see the fighting that's going on inside Iraq and the displacement which is going on there. One of the challenges is, what, when does this stop? Mm-hmm. How long do we have to keep trying to provide a humanitarian response to the political failures?
These political failures, he adds, could also spread the security crisis into neighboring countries. Outside Salah's house, his 15-year-old son, Zaid, entertains his younger siblings. He says no one expects the nearby wars to end soon, and he plans to join the military after he finishes school. He says he plans to defend the homeland, but his father says fears the war could expand are not nearly as troubling as fears the economy will further deteriorate, driving Jordanians from their homes and adding to the millions of displaced in the region. Salah adds after 4 years of war, he is increasingly anxious because every day it becomes more difficult to feed his children. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Amman, Jordan.
Kurdish forces in Iraq are investigating 2 more possible chemical weapons attacks by the Islamic State group. The allegations follow similar claims made last Saturday by Kurdish officials who said militants use chlorine gas to target Peshmerga forces. Kurdish militia leader General Aziz Wesi says one of the alleged attacks occurred in late December near the Sinjar area, and the others west of Mosul in late January. The looting and destruction of historic sites and artifacts by Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria continues to spark outrage around the world. Archaeologists are concerned that important and sensitive sites may be permanently damaged by extremists. As Kane Faribault reports, archaeologists and law enforcement officials are scrambling to prevent further loss of priceless cultural heritage.
They are images that have made headlines and provoked outrage around the world. Ancient and important archaeological sites hammered and bulldozed to the ground. What has survived the test of time has not survived the rise of militant Islam in parts of Syria and Iraq, countries home to ancient Mesopotamia, the so-called cradle of civilization. McGuire Gibson specializes in Mesopotamian archaeology at the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago.
This is the king himself standing and receiving these gifts.
He says the recent destruction at the Mosul Museum and the site of the ancient Assyrian capital of Nimrud is intended to provoke outrage.
It needles us. It makes us angry about it. It makes us depressed about it.
But Gibson says past experience demonstrates that militants could be using those images of destruction as a smokescreen for trafficking smaller, more valuable items out of the country.
There are people in the world who know what this stuff is worth, and it is very clear that at least part of the destruction of the Iraq Museum in 2003, that part of that was induced. Part of that was people on the outside getting dealers on the inside to get people to go into the museum to try to get specific things.
Archaeologists like Gibson have tried to locate and return those historic artifacts to Iraq's National Museum. It is an effort that continues today, despite the dangers in the region.
Well, there's archaeological work going on right now in Iraq. I mean, in the places where there it is relatively secure, work is going on. You know, whether or not it'll be secure next week, we don't know. But you know, we try to work when and where we can.
Edward Planch is a program specialist with United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. He says to help those archaeologists working on the ground, UNESCO is trying to bolster education efforts and artifact recovery at border checkpoints near Iraq and Syria.
So the objective is to have these surrounding countries with us, aware of the traffics, of the kind of objects going out, able to seize the pieces and keep them in safe place.
Many of the items in the Mosul Museum were digitally cataloged, which has helped these efforts. But recovering such treasures is sometimes difficult. The Iraqi National Museum, which opened in early March after being closed for 12 years, is still searching for some 15,000 items that went missing in the 2003 Iraq War. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Russian President Vladimir Putin appeared in public Monday following days of rumors that he was either ill, had died, or been ousted in a palace coup. Mr. Putin appeared with Kyrgyz President Almazbek Atambayev at St. Petersburg's Constantine Palace before the two leaders held talks. Mr. Putin was last seen in public March 5th. The United States and Germany have vowed to continue punishing Russia with economic sanctions for its annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, and warned of new measures if Moscow fails to fully back a ceasefire it endorsed last month. In Washington Monday, the U.S. State Department accused Moscow of carrying out a sham referendum in Crimea last year, ahead of a vote in the Russian parliament to annex the peninsula. In Berlin, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks with Ukraine's visiting president Petro Poroshenko. Experts say the rebels in eastern Ukraine are using sophisticated Russian weapons that require specialized skills to operate and could only have come directly from Russia. The analysis comes as both sides withdraw heavy weapons as part of the shaky ceasefire deal. VOA's Alpesin has details.
Inspectors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe check Ukrainian government rocket launchers being withdrawn from the front lines. 80 kilometers to the south, another team monitors the withdrawal of rebel tanks. But these are not necessarily the rebels' best weapons. The most modern items, apparently sent from Russia, are few in number, but potentially significant, says Nick Jensen-Jones, director of the consulting firm Armament Research Services, who spoke via Skype.
Some of the largest systems, even in the small numbers documented since we released the report, could prove, if not decisive, then certainly influential.
His firm's report says experts have misidentified weapons on both sides, but it confirms the rebels have weapons they could not have gotten from within Ukraine, as they claim. These range from modern rifles to new Russian battle tanks. Concerns about Russian weapons in eastern Ukraine and the potential for further Western military supplies to the Ukrainian government have eased somewhat because of the ceasefire. But if hostilities resume, the experts say the Ukrainians may need radar systems, anti-tank weapons, and other modern systems. But they also note Russia could counter any Western aid, potentially leading to an even deadlier conflict. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
The United Nations says a Category 5 cyclone had battered the South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu last week, killed at least 24 people. UN officials who arrived in the country Monday also say more than 3,000 people are homeless. The estimates are the first from the UN since Cyclone Pam tore a path of destruction through Vanuatu last Friday and Saturday. The death toll is expected to rise as aid workers and local authorities struggle to reestablish communications with the more than 80 islands that make up Vanuatu. How the world should protect itself from natural disasters and climate change and who should pay for it are being debated at the United Nations World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction in Sendai, Japan, which was devastated by an earthquake and tsunami in 2011. As delegates try to agree on a new framework, the aftermath of Cyclone Pam in the South Pacific is reminding them of the urgency of a deal. Henry Ridgewell reports from Sendai.
The conference is taking place against the backdrop of the devastation wrought by Cyclone Pam last week in Vanuatu. The island nation's president told delegates in Japan that development in his country had been wiped out. The cyclone changed its expected path at the last minute. Speaking at the conference, the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Michel Jarraud, told VOA early warning systems had saved lives in the South Pacific.
This kind of cyclone is very unusual. We are not even sure at this stage, because we still need to wait to see what was the exact strength of the cyclone, but it's very unusual. And it's even more challenging for a country to deal with hazards which don't happen regularly.
Delegates largely agree that natural disasters are inflicting a bigger toll on communities, but agreeing on how the risks should be mitigated is proving a more difficult task. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Sendai, Japan.
An American healthcare worker being treated for Ebola deteriorated to critical condition on Monday. The patient was flown home last week from West Africa and is now at the National Institute for Health in the eastern U.S. state of Maryland. The unidentified clinician tested positive for the Ebola virus while volunteering with Partners in Health at an Ebola treatment unit in Sierra Leone. 10 healthcare workers who came in contact with the patient in Sierra Leone were flown to the United States on Sunday. All are staying near hospitals with high-level biocontainment units capable of treating Ebola in case they become sick. Nigeria's military says it recaptured the key town of Bama in the country's northeast from Islamic militants who have controlled it since September. There was no independent verification of the report. Bama is the second biggest city in Borno State. The Obama administration is abandoning plans to cut the number of U.S. forces in Afghanistan to 5,500 by year's end, amid requests from military leaders to keep more troops there. Although no final decision on numbers has been made, the officials say most of the almost 10,000 U.S. troops currently in Afghanistan are expected to stay well into next year. An official announcement is likely next week when Afghan President Ashraf Ghani meets President Barack Obama in Washington. Despite much skepticism, a key Afghan minister insists talks with what he calls the violent opposition will start very soon. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has details from Islamabad.
Afghanistan's deputy foreign minister has said that his government has made progress in prospective peace talks with the Taliban. Without naming the group, Hikmat Khalil Karzai said direct talks between his government and what he called the violent opposition will start soon.
As we speak, the Afghan government is putting together an Afghan negotiation team, and a venue is being decided on where to hold these talks.
The deputy foreign minister made the statement at a foreign ministry-sponsored seminar in Kabul, jointly organized with a Chinese research organization. He encouraged China to use its influence with Pakistan to facilitate these talks. Afghanistan has often blamed Pakistan for sheltering members of the Afghan Taliban. Afghan officials also believe Pakistan wields enough influence over the group to force them to the negotiating table. When contacted by VOA, the Taliban spokesman said his group has no plans for negotiations with the Afghan government. Zabiullah Mujahid reiterated the group's position that talks with Kabul are not possible until foreign forces completely withdraw from Afghanistan. He also said the government in Kabul is not sovereign. Analysts suggest there may be divisions among the Taliban ranks on whether or not to hold peace talks with Kabul. If these talks do not start soon, it might have a negative impact on Afghanistan's relations with Pakistan as well. Afghan officials insist that if the upcoming spring fighting season is as bloody as previous ones, that would suggest that Islamabad has not targeted the Afghan Taliban in its recent offensive against militants. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
One of the world's most recognizable domes is getting a facelift. The U.S. Capitol Dome in Washington, D.C. is wrapped in metal scaffolding and fabric, all part of a long-overdue renovation project. VOA's Jeff Custer takes a look at restoration efforts for the enduring symbol of the U.S. government and American democracy.
The last time the U.S. Capitol Dome underwent a renovation was in 1960. Since then, the dome has become weathered and worn, and, as the architect of the Capitol reports, has more than 1,000 cracks and other defects. The dome was first completed around 1863. Its cast iron frame, says U.S. Senate historian Don Ritchie, has contributed to that weathering.
The Capitol dome, being cast iron, has been hit by lightning countless times, and it's been weathering that position since 1850, for 150 years, since 1863. And it has been leaking lately. And there's a lot of artwork inside, including the big canopy in the center. And so the current construction is to repair the leaks, to fill the cracks, to take off excess layers of paint, and to paint it again.
As the work to remove old paint and apply primer continues, a large section of the building is covered by plastic and a special pink fabric designed to reduce wind and protect workers from the elements. Much of the construction is done after dark to prevent the noise from disturbing lawmakers who continue to meet inside. Some visitors to the Capitol, hoping for a souvenir picture of the usually gleaming dome, have been let down by the current view.
It was dramatic. It's very fantastic. It's all white. But when I come here today, it's under construction, so my family can't see it clearly. It's kind of disappointed.
Other visitors have taken the construction in stride.
Well, you have to take the long view. I mean, it's a little inconvenient for us not to see the dome, but you have to think about the future and the people who could be coming to this place for centuries. And, you know, it just needs to be preventive maintenance occasionally. And I'm not upset with that at all.
The project is expected to take more than 2 years to totally complete. It is scheduled to be ready for the inauguration of a new president in February of 2017. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On March 17, 45 BC, Julius Caesar defeated Republican forces in the Battle of Munda in modern-day Spain. The victory led to his dictatorial rule of the Roman Empire, but that didn't last long. Caesar was murdered the following year on March 15th. March 17th is celebrated as St. Patrick's Day, a national and religious holiday in the Irish Republic in honor of the country's patron saint. It is thought to be the date on which he died in or about 460 A.D. In 1901, paintings by the Dutch master Vincent van Gogh were shown at a major Paris art gallery. The 71 paintings caused a sensation in the art world, bringing acclaim to the artist who had died a decade earlier. In 1905, on this date, future President Franklin Delano Roosevelt married his fifth cousin, once removed, Eleanor Roosevelt, in New York. In 1921, there was a revolt by Russian sailors in Kronstadt, a naval station on the Gulf of Finland that served as the base for the Russian Baltic Fleet. Thousands were killed in the unsuccessful uprising against the Bolsheviks. On March 17, 1941, the National Gallery of Art was dedicated in Washington, D.C. In 1959, the 14th Dalai Lama fled Tibet for India. He remained the leader of Tibetan exiles until his retirement on March 14, 2011. On this day in 1969, Golda Meir became the fourth Prime Minister of Israel. Born in Kiev, she grew up in the United States before immigrating in 1921 to Palestine, administered at that time by the British. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of the estimated 35.3 million people living with HIV/AIDS, some 3.2 million are children under the age of 15. Most of them, about 91%, live in sub-Saharan Africa. In 9 out of 10 cases, these children were infected during pregnancy, childbirth, or through breastfeeding. At birth, a baby's immune system is not fully developed. In a healthy child, it fully develops by about 6 months, but up to that point, the infant's immunity is boosted by antibodies transferred from the mother through breast milk. When mothers with HIV receive the proper medications, they can safely breastfeed their infants. However, when HIV-infected mothers do not receive anti-HIV medicines, their infants are at risk of becoming infected. Children with HIV infection often get sick. They have a difficult time fighting off common childhood maladies such as ear and sinus infections, pneumonias, urinary tract infections, intestinal illness, skin disease, and meningitis. In developing countries in particular, tuberculosis, diarrhea, and respiratory illnesses are common in HIV-positive children. If an HIV-positive child does not receive antiretroviral treatment, a cycle of illness may set in and further undermine the child's health. 80% of children infected with HIV at birth or in infancy die before their fifth birthday. It is therefore important to begin treating HIV-positive children with antiretroviral drugs as soon as possible. If taken every day, proper medication can drastically reduce the concentration of HIV in the bloodstream, thereby slowing the progression of the disease. But sadly, only 24% of HIV-infected children have access to antiretroviral drugs. That is why the United States, through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, in partnership with the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, launched the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment, or ACT, initiative. This two-year, $200 million program aims to double the number of children receiving antiretroviral treatment. Through this initiative, some 300,000 additional children living in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe will get a better chance to grow to adulthood and lead full, healthy lives. Healthy children who can pursue their dreams are Africa's future. They will grow economies, create jobs, and contribute to their families and communities for decades to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.